Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota is home to many species of fur-bearing animals. Trapping fur bearers not only serves as a recreational pastime in the state and a tool for wildlife management, but also allows sportsmen another opportunity to get outside in South Dakota. Mark Steck is from Dakota Lion Snares. He's the owner, and it's based out of Lenox, and he's joining us in the Kirby Family Studio in SDPB's Sioux Falls studio to talk about life as a trapper in the state of South Dakota. Welcome, Mark. Thanks for stopping by.
Yep. Pleasure to be here.
I'm very curious to know how you sort of got started in trapping and snaring. How old were you?
Well, I was probably 14, maybe 1971 or two. And it was a good way to make money. That was not my goal. There was just a lot of kids in the neighborhood in North Mankato that trapped. And so I was interested. I got hooked on it with a little bit of success off the bat. And I knew that I wanted to become better at it.
So back then, where would you have taken, do you call it a pelt? Or what, how would you have made money off of that activity back when you were that age?
Well, and I trapped mainly muskrats early on, and there were a lot of fur buyers around. I mean, there was high demand for furs, and so I learned how to skin them and put them up, stretch them, dry them, and then you would take them to the fur buyer. And I always had money in my pocket back then.
Yeah. Who taught you?
Well, one of my best friends, their family trapped muskrats, which is pretty basic trapping. And then on my paper route, there was an old guy. He was almost, I say old, but he was almost, I think he was 50 years older than me almost to the day. His name was Patrick. And so one day I worked up the nerve to ask him if I could go along with him. I was always spying on him, checking out the back of his truck when I'd see it, you know, and because I knew he was a good mink trapper. And turned out he was just a very friendly guy. And back in those days, nobody would tell you anything. It was very secretive. And Pat and I became close friends. And so I learned a lot from him. And in fact, when I was a senior in high school, he had cancer, and I'd drive him to the Mayo Clinic. I'd skip school, and so he passed when I was a senior in high school. But he told me once, the very first time I went trapping with him, I skipped school. I was in the ninth grade, and you know, he knew nobody would tell me anything. And he said to me, "If you can't help somebody, what the hell good are you?" Those were his exact words, and I never forgot those words.
So you went out with him. It wasn't just him giving you a tip or, you know, sharing a book with you. It was a hands-on experience together.
Yep, I'll never forget it. Yeah. And he was a very happy man, and he did cement work. But in the fall, he went trapping for mink and muskrats.
Tell me when you sort of knew that this was something that you wanted to do for a long, like, what was the appeal at 14? Clearly skipping school seems like it was more fun for you than sitting in a classroom, but what was the draw?
It was a challenge, and I do recall an article in the Minneapolis Tribune about a guy that was out of high school, and he'd spend all fall and winter trapping, and I cut the article out, and I read it many times, and I thought, I want to do that. I want to trap and make my living trapping. And and also trapping is kind of, it can become an addiction, kind of like archery hunting for deer. And it's that anticipation of your catch. And I did what I call long line for quite a few years, where that was my main income. And I didn't have a steady job till I was 28. I got married and knew I wanted a family. But it was the challenge, and it was being close to the earth that I liked.
Yeah. Let's talk about that a little bit, because is it a time-consuming activity? Does it take a lot of time and a lot of time outside to really come home with a successful day?
It is a commitment, number one, because you put your traps in and you're committed to check them and pull them out of the ground when the time comes. And so that in itself is a commitment. And not all days are good. Your big catches come in spurts. I mean, you may hit bad weather. You may hit a day where it's just steady rain and it's hard to get around. And the idea for some people of running long trap lines is a romantic one. And I think that I was in that category of thinking that. But it's very hard work. And the harder you trap, the more work it is, of course. I lose weight during the trapping season. I've lost as much as 15 pounds during the trapping season. And it's very physical, but it's very rewarding too.
Do you think about those original trappers, you've got gear now, warm weather gear, for example, that they didn't have in the early days of trapping in this region? Do you feel a connection to sort of the people who came before you, whether indigenous people or some of the early trappers that came to the area?
I don't know that I feel a connection, but I have high respect for what they endured, because I trap out of a vehicle. I don't walk that much anymore. I get close with these 4x4s and so forth. And these guys back in the day that were forging the ways out west, and the brutal winters, the high altitudes, and even handling their beavers, skinning them and putting them up, I don't know how they did it. Mm-hmm. I honestly don't know how they did it. And all I know for sure is they were tough. And I even read a story once. Jim Bridger, he ran out of food. Maybe I read what I wanted to read, but I read that he ate a pair of pants. He was, I don't know if that's conceivable or not,
yeah.
So I feel a brotherhood, but I feel more respect, and yeah. It's a different time now.
Yeah, if you're in the wrong spot, you can become pretty desperate, I think, is the message of the pants-eating story. How desperate does a person have to be before they resort to eating things like that, right?
I would think pretty desperate, pretty hungry.
How has it changed now when you look at 2019 and you started trapping in the 70s? There must be a huge... Now, you came to South Dakota largely because you wanted to live in a place where it was better. Tell us a little bit about coming to South Dakota and making your home here.
Well, I finished college in 1983, or actually 1982. And it took me 6 years because I wouldn't go. We had quarters, and I would not go to the fall quarters. And I'd go during the summer. And first I moved to North Dakota because there were a lot of fox up there. And then I decided to move to South Dakota. And that's where I made my home. I met my wife here, and I worked for the National Park Service. I got a job there working summers and everything at Wind Cave, from giving cave tours to fighting fires and so forth. And I love the opportunities of South Dakota, not nearly as many people as Minnesota, where I grew up. And so whether it's hunting or trapping, South Dakota is where I knew I wanted to be once I got here.
All right, let's talk about it changing. What is it like today versus what it was like trapping in your younger years?
Well, anybody that hunts or traps that has any years behind them can go back to their spots and where they first trapped. And man has tamed the land more and more. I mean, creeks are straightened out and things change enormously. The gas-powered engine has only been around 120 years or so, and so there's roads and there's equipment that can make land more tillable and so forth, and so a lot has changed. Also, what I do see changing is in South Dakota is you have a big city. Sioux Falls has changed so much, and that in itself... You can look at other states. Montana is a big one where there's a lot of out-of-staters that move there because of the mountains. And so trapping has faced from city dwellers and urban dwellers and people coming in from California and bringing their beliefs with them. It's faced pressure now in South Dakota, and there's constant pressure to eliminate trapping. And so that's something that... we're seeing more and more. And it's not the landowners. It's not the small cities. It's these urban people moving into the Black Hills and Sioux Falls.
What is their opposition as you see it? What do you mostly hear? Are they concerned about just the killing itself? Are they concerned about the ecosystem? What are some of the arguments that you hear from some of those urban dwellers?
By and large, they do not want killing of any animals. And so trapping is the first target because we're a small fraternity compared to hunting. But they're after everything, right down to ranching. There is no limits with these people. And some are small groups, but they have connections and attorneys with large international groups. And so recently there was some proposed regulation going to the Game, Fish, and Parks Commission. And there's clear evidence that attorneys over in the UK wrote this legislation. I mean, there's a direct link. And so it's a never-ending pressure. And I don't know the future of how much they can change the world, but they aren't going to give up.
What do they not understand about trapping in South Dakota that you wish you could explain to them?
There's the primary thing they don't understand is that animals die, period. They die. Most animals don't make it through a winter. Nature is harsh. Mother Nature is very harsh. And they don't like, there's a couple things they don't like. They don't like the trappers harvesting these renewable resources because it's appalling to them, an animal in a trap. What they don't see is I catch a lot of mangy coyotes in there. They're so cold and they're so fragile that they live in hay bales just to stay warm. They don't see how harsh Mother Nature is, and they don't understand that this is a renewable resource, in that we manage this resource. With man coming to the land, it has become so necessary for us to manage these resources because man, in the way we live, has upset the balance in a big, big way. And so when I trap for ranchers, and they don't like coyotes because they'll take cattle, calves, and in one case, a full-grown cow got stuck in the fence, and I got to witness this. And by morning, there was hardly anything left of it. There might have been up to a dozen coyotes that killed that thing alive and ate it and had the feeding frenzy. And to me, that's just nature. That's just nature. That's how cruel nature is. And it's not here and there. It's every day. Nature is very, very cruel. And compared to me harvesting critters in a professional and expert way, it's nothing. It's absolutely nothing in terms of suffering.
For people who hunt, hunters are always, trying to get the word out about ethical hunting, and especially during a hunting season like pheasant season, where you get a lot of out of town people who maybe don't play by the same rules. Is there an ethic to trapping? Is that something that you want to continue to educate people on how to do it effectively, how to do it well, and to sort of minimize unethical trapping and snaring?
Yeah, absolutely, and. And we see not necessarily unethical trapping when fur prices all of a sudden get good, but we see people that aren't skilled in it, and it is a skill. And it's very learnable skill, but when I trap, I have the utmost respect for critters, for the animals, whether it's coyotes or fox, beaver, whatever. I want them, for various reasons, I want them dead quickly, and I want their pelts in good shape, and I need to check my traps on a regular basis. And so, yes, you can get trappers when prices are high that are unethical, but there's laws to keep them in place, and so other trappers normally take care of those trappers by working with game wardens. We work hard to protect what we have, And we work hard to set traps in a way that dogs won't get hurt, for instance. And so, yeah, it's always a challenge.
Tell me how to bring that next generation into. You mentioned when you first got started, you know, it's kind of, you know, secretive. People aren't going to share their tricks and their knowledge. Times have changed. We have the internet. You have a business. There's been news in South Dakota about getting kids into this recreational activity. Where do you begin if there's a young person who sort of wants to learn about trapping, how to do it well, skillfully, and how to do it right?
Well, and to clarify, I've taken, maybe up to 50 kids under my wings, and they normally find me, and somebody knows about me, and they tell somebody, because I love taking kids. I get to see it through their eyes, and I have fun with them. I screw with them a little bit, and a lot of them I've watched grow up, and some are married now. We stay in touch. They have kids. They have professional careers. And so I enjoy that. I enjoy it a lot. And there have been times where there hasn't been kids to go with me. Once I put a message on Facebook, do you know of any kids that want to go with me? Because it's such an opportunity to expose kids to this. Some of them get totally addicted to it. Then they go away to college, and then maybe they come back, and they're busy. But at some point in their life, they're going to get back into it, maybe just here and there, maybe when they have their own kids. But they all remember it fondly, with fondness. And I run into these kids, and when they talk about it and remember this and remember that, and it's a great passion that can absorb you.
What's the thrilling part for them? Is it the catch or is it the tracking? Is it just being outside? Like, what are some of the things that years later they're still telling the stories about?
Well, some of it is the anticipation of checking traps. And then every time they'll go and set their own traps, and it's their first catch they remember, or their first coyote or their first mink. They love talking about that, but more importantly, I think when I run into them, they like to talk about something that happened. For instance, maybe my truck broke through a beaver run and we were stuck. They remember things like that. We had to walk to a farmer's place, you know, and it's those type of things, that they remember a lot.
Can someone make a living like you were in your early 20s? Is there still an economic opportunity for trappers?
It's tough. Most trappers that are making their living are doing animal damage control. There may be trapping beaver for farmers. Beaver do a lot of damage. Coyotes. Some ranchers will get associations together, and then they'll contract with trappers. In terms of fur, it's really very hard to make a living doing that.
Owner of Dakota Line Snares, what kind of gear do people need to get started in trapping? How do you sort of walk people through the beginning and what's new in gear?
Well, there's not a lot new in gear. Gear has just gotten better. It's gotten more animal friendly. Techniques have gotten better, more effective and efficient. You know, a person needs traps or snares, and they need some ambition. They need some technique. They need some smelly stuff in a lot of cases.
Some smelly stuff. Explain.
Yeah. Well, like for raccoon, I use a sweet smelling stuff that makes you want to eat it. It smells so good. Now for canines, I use something stronger. It may have skunk in it. It may have glands, canine glands in it. It may have beaver castor in it. And so the key is to getting them to work your set so they get caught.
Yeah. Mark Stack, thank you so much for being here with us today. We really appreciate your time.
Again, I'm very happy to be here.